Welcome to the third installment of the Locked On NBA Preview Edition here on Locked On Podcast Network. It's our third and final look at the Western Conference. It's the Northwest Division. We'll start with the Denver Nuggets. We'll then head to the Portland Trailblazers, the Utah Jazz, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and the Minnesota Timberwolves in order to finish in last year's division. Some great hosts here for you on the Local Experts, plus we'll have Noah Kozlov and Adam Stanko of Rejecting the Screen giving you tomorrow's headlines. And the number one fantasy basketball show in the land is Locked On Fantasy Basketball, currently in the top 50 of the iTunes charts. It's hosted by Josh Lloyd, Locked On Fantasy Basketball, and Josh will stop by and give us his insight on each and every team. The Pacific Division has already been done. The Southwest Division's already been done. It's on the Locked On NBA feed, so make sure you grab those. Let's get this started. The NBA preview of the Northwest Division, courtesy of Locked On NBA and the Locked On Podcast Network, like nobody else can do it, with our local experts on the biggest stories. Adam Modis does a fabulous job with the Locked On Nuggets show. You also can catch him Fridays on Locked On NBA with Anthony Irwin, and here he'll start us off with a look inside the Nuggets. It's the storylines, the breakout players, the career trajectory changing players, and how the Nuggets will finish it up. Here's Adam.
Hey everyone, it's Adam Mattes, co-host of the Locked On Nuggets podcast, along with Matt Moore. I take over the front half of the week every week. Matt Moore takes over in the back half. And I want to talk to you today about some of the biggest storylines surrounding the Denver Nuggets. First up, the addition of Jeremy Grant, who flew under the radar in the free agency trade chaos this summer. Jeremy Grant came over in that fire sale in Oklahoma City and is expected to be a big contributor on the Denver Nuggets this season, coming off the bench probably to start the season and maybe even for the entire season, but will be one of the main pieces of the rotation. And not just this year, but for years to come. The Nuggets brought him in hoping that he would be the power forward fit alongside Nikola Jokic for years and years to come. How he fits in and just if he elevates their ceiling at all is a big question for them this season. Of course, the debut of Michael Porter Jr. We've been waiting 2 years to see this guy. Finally got to see him in preseason, and through two games, he's really, really looked strong. Can he stay healthy, and can he crack the rotation? Obviously, he's a player with a ton of upside, and if he pans out the way that he was projected to before the back injuries, then he's a player that really elevates Denver's ceiling. Could be their second best or maybe even first best player, depending on just how well he recovers from those two back surgeries. And then lastly, who's on the roster at the end of the year? The Denver Nuggets have built their culture around internal growth, keeping guys. They've had the most continuity of any team by leaps and bounds over the last three seasons, and that continues into this season. But with a lot of players heading into contract years, this is the year where Denver might have to start cannibalizing some of those guys. A lot of the young pieces who have, you know, come off the bench and kind of worked their way up over the last two or three seasons, now they're looking to either be paid or just get bigger roles. And at what point does that continuity turn into guys being disgruntled with such little roles? I think that's a big question this year, and I anticipate that the Denver Nuggets will be one of the active participants at the NBA trade deadline. What needs to happen for a best-case scenario for the Nuggets? There's a lot of avenues for improvement for Denver, and that's one of the things that I think makes them such a hot pick to be a very good regular season team. Of course, Jamal Murray making a leap is the biggest part of that. He shot 40% from the three-point line over the back half of the season, the final 41 games, and of course had a pretty strong playoff debut, back-to-back 35-point games on the road in games 3 and 4 in Portland, and just had some really big moments. If he makes a leap and becomes a more consistent player, playing more at what he looks like at his best, then Denver goes up another level and they probably have a true second star player. Gary Harris, Juancho Hernangómez, and or Will Barton just being better this season. All three of those players battled injuries last year and played well below their career averages. Jeremy Grant replacing Trey Lyles, probably the worst of the nine players in the rotation last season for Denver by quite a bit. Jeremy Grant replacing him should elevate not just their second unit, but also the mix and match combinations you can throw between starters and bench. Jokic improving. He's only 24 years old, and as great as he played last year, an MVP candidate, I think fourth in the MVP voting, does he have another level of growth in him? We saw that in the playoffs, that he upped his minutes, upped his production. Can he do that now over the course of the regular season? Michael Porter Jr., of course, being a positive impact player. If that happens, of course, Denver's ceiling improves. And then also just internal improvement from guys like Malik Beasley, Monte Morris, maybe even Torrey Craig, these guys that have only played in the NBA for two or three seasons, they should be expected to improve as well. So there's a lot of avenues for Denver to get better. Worst case scenario, I mentioned before, those seven players in contract years, does Denver has been such an unselfish team and a balanced team, did they lose a little bit of that as guys are looking to get paid, or is there a little bit of less happy locker room, good players that just don't crack the rotation? And then, of course, Jamal Murray got a $170 million contract. Does that change his approach at all? Does he maybe try to take over too much? That could be a negative. And then stylistically, I think the team, one of their strengths is that continuity, so you would expect that they play largely the same on offense, but the big change is that they were one of the least athletic teams last year, especially with Gary Harris and Will Barton both being injured. Now you get those guys back to full health. You add Jeremy Grant. You add Michael Porter Jr. They should be one of the more long, fast, athletic teams, especially in that second unit. Players most likely to be thought of differently this season. I think this is a big year for Jeremy Grant. It's a contract year, so of course he's playing for that. But also, he sort of blossomed over the last season in Oklahoma City. And I suspect that in this more democratic offense in Denver, he'll get more touches and just more opportunities to sort of stretch his wings. And then offensively, every player gets elevated playing alongside Jokic. So it seems like he's a guy that could really turn some heads this year. And then Malik Beasley might be one of the players most likely to be traded from Denver, but he shot the ball so well and sort of started to break out last year. I suspect you'll hear his name called quite a bit. Rookies that'll have an impact, of course, Michael Porter Jr. is the answer here. Don't know for sure that he will be in the rotation because of how competitive Denver is, but I think that Denver is very incentivized to sort of give him minutes and see what he's got and start to develop him, as he's such a high upside player and piece of their future. And then my best guess on how the season ends, I think Denver wins the one or the two seed. They have a great regular season roster. They won 54 games last year despite all of the injuries. I think they were the third most injured team last year, so should be even better this year. I think that they're going to be a great regular season team. I think they're forced to make a trade at the deadline. I think they'll be one of the teams in the mix for that Andre Iguodala deal at the trade deadline. Maybe Malik Beasley and Will Barton, Juancho Hernangómez, players like that, Torrey Craig even, Mason Plumlee you could throw in. A lot of guys that they could throw into a trade that have some value. And then I think in the playoffs, they still are going to struggle against some of your more premier teams, the Lakers, the Clippers, the Rockets. Those are teams that just have the more top-heavy talent that seems to be more important in the playoffs. Not a given, but certainly how I would predict the season to go. Should be a fun one for Denver. Very fun team, and a lot of interesting storylines surrounding them. Of course, you can hear about all those storylines from myself and my co-host, Matt Moore, senior NBA writer for the Action Network, over on the Locked On Nuggets podcast. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you over there.
Strangely, the Locked On Podcast Network points gain system doesn't love Denver offensively, which it should. I'm not entirely clear why. Jeremy Grant is such a perfect fit. Really, frankly, Gary Harris did not have a very good year last year and should be much improved. And so he brings the numbers down. And the same story is true on Will Barton. If those two players can get back closer to league average, then they'll be much better. And obviously, Jamal Murray is a below average offensive player with a lot of pressure on him. So you have three of their five primary offensive possession users who come out as negative, and that's a huge part of points gain. So Denver only comes out as the 14th best offense and the 13th best defense and the 7th ranked team in the Western Conference. I don't believe the numbers at all on that one. Feel pretty comfortable that Denver could, if I had to put money down for number one seed, I think Denver's got as good a chance as anyone, but the numbers did not love them. Let's find out what tomorrow's headlines are from Noah Kozlov and Adam Stanko. Make sure you grab their program on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. It's called Rejecting the Screen. They had Sam Mitchell on this week. It's going to be a great deal of fun to hear that interview for you. And then Josh Lloyd will follow them with his look at the fantasy breakdown.
The Denver Nuggets. A popular under-the-radar, I guess any team out west is an under-the-radar team to win the West if it's not the Clippers or the Lakers. But here's the headline I see coming for the Denver Nuggets. And it deals with Jokic. Who cares if he's fat? Until April. So, doesn't look like he's in great shape. But, it doesn't matter until April. You know, on Basketball Reference, Adam, one of his nicknames is Big Honey.
I did not know that.
I wonder if he knows that.
Is that what you call him?
Last year, during the regular season, he was 31 minutes a night. In the playoffs, he was 40 minutes a night at 25, 13, and 8, which is just stupid. So he was able to ramp that up. So again, as long as he's not fat in the playoffs, all right. And last year, they were a top 10 offense and defensive team, and they need Jokic on the floor at end of games. So he's got to get into shape. But again, who cares if he's fat now?
See, for me, the future headline is Michael Porter is one of the favorites for Rookie of the Year. And it's probably because I really want to see this, because I want to see all the people starting to bring up the Ben Simmons arguments, which will then turn into Ben Simmons, Donovan Mitchell jokes and memes that we're going to get if this indeed happens. But the Nuggets need a third star badly. A lot of pressure to put on a guy who hasn't played in the NBA yet. But if he stays healthy, I know it's a huge if, but Michael Porter Jr. could be that third guy for this Nuggets team with Jamal Murray and the Joker. And I love Big Honey as much as anyone. And I love Jamal Murray too. Is he Little Honey in that instance? But regardless of what the case is, if Michael Porter Jr. Ooh, that we're in. Big Honey and Piglet. And Michael Porter Jr. as the third star, he becomes one of the favorites for Rookies of the Year.
The Denver Nuggets return a team that's fairly similar to last season. They do add Jeremy Grant. It's going to be hard for Grant to replicate what he did with the Thunder. He won't be getting the same level of minutes. Paul Millsap and Nikola Jokic are in front of him. Maybe he plays some minutes at the three, but all he is really is a late round blocks type of streamer. He did hit his threes at a solid rate last season. The volume's not all that high. He's not a great rebounder. More of that waiver wire type addition. Jokic should be the number six player off the board in nearly all fantasy basketball leagues, while Jamal Murray's minutes and numbers should be fairly similar to what we saw last season. I'd expect guys like Monty Morris and Malik Beasley to see their minutes drop down a little bit. That's assuming the health of Will Barton and Gary Harris, who were injured for big chunks of last season, enabling Beasley and Morris to take a step forward. As for Harris, his minutes dropped way off last year. His shooting dropped off as well. I think a bounce back is on the cards. Not back to being a top 50 guy, but at least having a chance to crack into the top 100. While Michael Porter has looked okay during the preseason, I just don't see a large enough role for Porter this season to be really knocking on the door of any sort of standard league value. While someone like Paul Millsap and Mason Plumlee, I imagine their playing time drops a little bit this season with that addition of Grant, and I don't think either of those should be looked at in a 12-team standard fantasy league.
Denver probably sits as the odds-on favorite to the Northwest Division. The Portland Trailblazers and Terry Stotts always seem to overperform what's expected. They changed up their roster a good deal. Al Farouk and Mo Harkless are gone. Michael Richmond is your pass-first point guard, as he loves to say before every show. He'll even do it today for you. And he breaks down where the Blazers are and gives us an insight onto the Portland Trailblazers this season and whether or not all the changes will be for the positive.
What up, world? It's your pass-first point guard and Blazer beat writer Mike Richmond, and here's your Blazers season preview. Two biggest storylines for the Blazers this season are, first, how the team fares without Yusuf Nurkic, and specifically how Hassan Whiteside fares filling in at center for Nurkic, who was just fantastic last year, probably one of the most underappreciated players in the league for my money. But the Blazers added Hassan Whiteside as the starting center, and it's going to be a big test for him, sort of how he can fill in and whether he can play at the level that Nurkic did to get the Blazers to be the 3 seed in the West. And the other big storyline is just how the young kids play. The Blazers clear the decks so Anfernee Simons can have real minutes playing backup at both guard spots, and they basically don't have any power forwards on the roster, so Zach Collins can start at power forward and play a ton of minutes there. And that's the real test. Is Anfernee Simons ready to play 25 minutes a night and be an NBA scorer? We just haven't seen much from him, less than 200 minutes in his rookie season. And while Zach Collins has shown flashes with real defensive potential and some shooting touch, he hasn't really been a big minute type of guy. And there'll be a test for him whether he can play 30 plus minutes and avoid foul trouble and do all those things. And really, what needs to happen for the Blazers to reach their best case scenario is for both of those things to work out well. Hassan Whiteside needs to be a defensive anchor and at least a reasonable replacement for what Yusuf Nurkic brought on offense. And Anfernee Simons has to be ready. Maybe not as much pressure on Simons as there is on Zach Collins. I think the Blazers can survive if Simons isn't ready until, say, February or March. Kent Bazemore should be a recent replacement for his minutes. They can just stretch Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum out a little bit at both guard spots and kind of make up for what Simons may or may not bring at age 20. But With Collins, I don't think the Blazers are so lucky. If he's not ready to be a real contributor, they're going to be in trouble. So if the Blazers are going to reach their sort of best case scenario type season, and from the way they've been talking in the preseason, the best case scenario for them means winning the West and playing in the NBA Finals. They're talking about Larry O'Brien trophies out here in the Pacific Northwest. It means that Collins needs to be ready. He needs to be ready to play 30 minutes a night. He needs to avoid foul trouble. He needs to probably shoot about league average from the three-point line and be a NBA power, starting NBA power forward. That's what the best case scenario looks like. The worst case scenario is just, quite simply, just Hassan Whiteside looks like the Hassan Whiteside of the last two seasons. Inconsistent effort, inconsistent production, and not a defensive factor. Someone who blocks shots and eats up rebounds, but isn't sort of a plus center, isn't one of the 10 best centers in the NBA by any measurement. If Hassan Whiteside is the Hassan Whiteside who showed up in Miami the past two seasons, that's probably somewhere towards the Blazers' worst case scenario, simply because they don't have a lot of other options. Like I said, if they basically, the only power forward they have in the roster that isn't Zach Collins is Anthony Tolliver. Zach Collins is also probably their best backup center, because behind Hassan Whiteside, it's Pau Gasol or Scalabissiere. I can't imagine a team making the Western Conference playoffs, making the playoffs in the West, much less winning the West, where Pau Gasol at age 39 and Scalabissiere are major contributors. That just seems unlikely. So if the worst case scenario is that Hassan Whiteside isn't ready to soak up 29 minutes a night, and if he has to soak up 29 minutes a night because the Blazers don't have any options, the worst case scenario is that he's just not very good. Stylistically, though, I don't think the Blazers are going to change much. You know, they added six new players. They've got a little bit more shooting than they've had in the past. A few more ball handlers by adding Kent Bazemore and Mario Hezonja, and to a certain extent, Rodney Hood. But defensively, they're going to look pretty similar. They're going to drop bigs. They're not going to be a high turnover team. I don't think you're going to see them run and trap. They're going to let the big sag back in the paint and try to force teams into taking mid-range jumpers. With Zach Collins and Hassan Whiteside on the front line, they'll probably be a little bit better around the rim defensively. You know, they just have a lot of length, more length than they've had in the past. But functionally, even if they protect the rim and you know, they're tough in the paint and they run guys off the three-point line as they've done in the past, it'll still look pretty similar to the way they've looked. And now, offensively, the Blazers are talking about running more. Add them to the list of 25 other teams talking about playing faster in the preseason. That's what everyone talks about. The Blazers do, however, have probably players that can functionally play faster. They just have more dudes who can dribble on the team. Like I mentioned, Bazemore and Hezonja are people who can actually put the ball on the floor and create a little bit for themselves. Blazers didn't really have wings like that in the past, so they'll look a little bit different just by virtue of having other guys who can attack either in transition or just in secondary action stuff, and that it's not just Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum coming down every single time down the floor. That said, it's going to be a lot of Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum. Those dudes are still the best player on the team, and the offense is largely still going to run through both of them. The player most likely to be thought about differently this season is Whiteside, because from an outside perspective, I think people kind of think that he's not very good. So if he pops in Portland, maybe that'll change dramatically. But here in Portland, there's really high expectations. So if he flops, people are going to be, they're going to have their opinion change pretty quickly here in Portland. So while that's two different views and it could go either way, I think a lot of the season rides on sort of what Whiteside brings. And in terms of a player whose career trajectory could be impacted the most this season, in a lot of ways, I think it's Anfernee Simons. The rest of the Blazers' rotation is veterans. They kind of are what they are. You know what 30-year-old Kent Bazemore does. You know what Dame and CJ bring to the table, and they're under contract for four or five more seasons. But Simons is kind of an unknown. But in Portland, the hype is incredibly loud around this kid. Maybe too loud. So I think if he has a chance to pop and really become kind of like a secondary star for this team, but he also has a chance to maybe be a victim of early preseason hype. Blazers have one rookie on the roster in Azir Little. He's not going to play, so you can watch him, but you'd have to come to the practice facility. And my best guess for how this season ends? I kind of think it's how the Blazers season always ends. They win two more games than Vegas thinks they're supposed to, and they finish in the top half of the West. I have him pegged at about 48 and probably fourth in the West, fourth or fifth. You know, 48 might sound a little bit low, so maybe they drop down to six. But I think this team is pushing 50 wins, especially if Yusuf Nurkic comes back in February and is healthy.
Again, another team that the points gained system of the Locked On Podcast Network doesn't love. Portland, all the changes they made, as much as Mo Harkless and Al Farouk are two of the least good shooters in the league at their position, they got enough dunks, they got enough backdoor cuts, they got enough trips to the free throw line that they came out as average offensive players. And the players, Kent Bazemore is a negative, considerably negative player. Rodney Hood's negative. Anthony Simons projects to be negative. Mario Hezonja negative. Anthony Tolliver's just league average. So, and frankly, CJ McCollum last year was just average in his use of possessions. So Portland, who was the number one offensive team in the league in after the first of the year last year, in the points gained system, comes out as 23rd this year, which is incredibly hard to believe. So both Portland and Denver screwy on our projection system. But if you're true to the projection system, you look at it and you don't change it and you just don't believe it. They come out as 13th in the Western Conference. That would be an incredibly disappointing day and have long-term ramifications for Portland. Be surprising if they truly are that poor. Let's find out what tomorrow's headlines are from Rejecting the Screen, hosted by Noah Kozlov and Adam Stenko.
The Portland Trailblazers headline, overachieving again. So when can we put to rest the Portland Trailblazers overachieving? Well, I know Terry Stotts doesn't ever want to put that to rest, because if you overachieve, you continue to keep your job. And then Terry Stotts deserves to have his job. They've hit the over 5 of the last 6 years. So when are they just good? So I think actually this year the offense might take a step back. They lost Harkless and Aminu and Jake Layman and Myers Leonard, Evan Turner. So they lost a lot of pieces, and this Hassan Whiteside stuff is a fascinating experiment. But again, Portland is going to be overachieving, and I just want to hear anybody else say, maybe they're just good.
I love it. I love it. I think that's totally fair. For me, the Blazers' future headline is best shooting team in the league. Now, we know about Lillard and McCollum, of course. Rodney Hood's playoff emergence. But what about Kent Bazemore, Mario Hezonja, Anthony Simons, and even Zach Collins? We have multiple guys who can shoot the three, multiple guys who could be consistent outside shooters. Are they going to be really good as it pertains to your original headline? I don't know. But in terms of being a shooting team, they are going to be one of the best in the league.
Big changes in Portland. Al Farouk Aminu and Mo Harkless are out. Yusuf Nurkic is injured. Hassan Whiteside comes in as the starting center. I think Whiteside's being a little bit undervalued in fantasy at the moment. He's going to be playing fairly big minutes early on. Maybe when Nurkic returns, it drops off, but Nurkic won't be back until February, March at the earliest. And when he returns, his playing time is not going to be back at 30 minutes straight away. So I do like Whiteside in those mid rounds. Zach Collins looks like he'll be the starting power forward next to Whiteside. He is undervalued at the moment as well. He can block shots. He can hit threes. Strong shooting numbers, especially from the free throw line. Solid rebounder. And he's going to be getting a lot of minutes, which puts some real value into Zach Collins at the back end of fantasy leagues. Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum. I think we might see a marginal drop off for Lillard this season, just with going a little bit more offensive with Rodney Hood and Kent Bazemore coming into the lineups. Lillard's usage has declined for four straight years, maybe a slight tick down again. He is still the consensus number 7 pick in a fantasy basketball league. Well, CJ McCollum, I don't think he's worth a top 50 pick. He's going to score. He'll hit threes. He doesn't do a huge amount else there. While Hood and Bazemore, who'll be fighting for those minutes at small forward, both of those guys are probably best left on the waiver wire in the majority of fantasy basketball situations.
Remember, you can get Josh Lloyd and Locked On Fantasy Basketball on all of your podcast providers. It's the number one fantasy basketball and daily fantasy basketball show in the country. So make sure you get Josh, even though he's not in the country, he's the number one show in the country. Our third stop is the Utah Jazz, and that leads us back to me. Now I flip hats from host of our preview shows to insider and host of Locked On Jazz. By now you know that I'm David Locke. The Utah Jazz are a considerably different basketball team than they were the last 2 years. It was a Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert Wasatch front mountain range on the defensive side for the Jazz. They always had an elite defender on the floor, and that is the biggest change. The overall storyline difference of the Utah Jazz in this season is a what you might call a modernization of the offense, an open of spacing, a bunch of offseason moves, all of which were offensively designed. They acquire Mike Conley to be the point guard, exchanging him for Ricky Rubio, one of the least good shooters in the league. They replace Jay Crowder and Derek Favors with Bojan Bogdanovic, and they add Jeff Green in the offseason. All three offensive-minded players, a team that's been in the middle of the pack offensively but just wasn't good enough offensively the last 2 years when they played the Houston Rockets. Even if their defense was good against the Rockets, the Jazz offense could not keep up with where the Rockets were offensively. If you look back at those two playoff series, the Jazz defense actually held the Rockets to their average or below average in most of the games, but the Jazz offense wasn't good enough to get up to what the Rockets' average or below average offensive game was, and so the Jazz got beat in both of those series very handily. The Favors-Gobert lineup had gone as long as it possibly could, and it was time to make a change. The Jazz have always been better with Gobert and a stretch four on the floor. They've been as good defensively, they've been better offensively, but it does take away one of their better players. Derek Favors is a fabulous player, as much as he was not a good mix for this roster where it is. The other storyline is Mike Conley and Donovan Mitchell and what the two of them will do for each other. Donovan Mitchell, last year's second scorer, was probably either Ricky Rubio or Joe Ingles. He had an incredibly high usage rate. He seemed overwhelmed by it at times and was incredibly inefficient in the postseason against the Houston Rockets. His second half of the season was a great uptick from his first half of the season, and it's not uncommon that a player who has a great rookie year kind of stays flat in his second year and then maybe has the jump in the third year. The De'Aaron Foxes of the world who have a bad first year are the ones who usually have the jump to the second year. Good rookies don't usually get a great deal better. We'll see what happens with Luka Doncic and Trae Young this year, or whether they wait till their third year to make the stretch. So what will Mike Conley do for Donovan Mitchell? Frankly, what will Bojan Bogdanovic do for Donovan Mitchell? The flip side is that Mike Conley has been playing point guard without any wing scorers since Rudy Gay left in 2012. He's been playing with Tayshaun Prince and Tony Allen and Avery Bradley and Dylan Brooks and those likes. And Mike Conley, for the first time in his career, will not have to bring the ball up the floor every time, will not have to conduct everything in the offense. Last year, in the entire season, Mike Conley only had 99 uncontested catch-and-shoot shots for the year. Open catch-and-shoot shots from Mike Conley last year, 99 in the entire season. So that'll be the biggest change. And then the Jazz will always come back to the big man in the middle, Rudy Gobert, and the defense, the two-time defensive player of the year. If Rudy Gobert is able to still have a dominating impact defensively, then this team is great. If at the end of the year we're talking about Rudy Gobert as a defensive player of the year, then the Utah Jazz are probably the one or two seed in the Western Conference, because if his defense is so good that this smaller team, the Jazz have been always been big, they're now small, are able to still be a top five defensive team with the improved offensive team that will almost certainly be a top 10 offensive team, then this is one of the best teams in the Western Conference. Rudy Gobert being discussed as defensive player of the year, and the Jazz will, that is their best case. The worst case scenario for the Jazz is they're not particularly athletic and they're not big. Mike Conley at 32 years old. Bojan Bogdanovic is not a great athlete. Joe Ingles is a sneaky, better, longer player, but, you know, speed wise, that's not entirely his deal. Donovan's a little small for his position. Do the Jazz defensively just become too small and not be able to rebound well enough for this team to be? They were the number one defensive rebounding team in the league last year. Are they able to rebound? Are they able to defend still? If they are not able to do that, then they've really just completely flipped who they are as a team from being an average offensive team in Quinn Snyder's system to being an elite defensive team. And anytime you're top five in either, it's great. All of a sudden, the worst case for the Jazz is they drop out of the top five in both. They become an above-average defensive team. They become a good offensive team. They're not in the top five in each. And then they're just kind of a middle-of-the-pack good Western Conference team, but all the changes don't make them elite. Stylistically, I think they'll be very different in the sense of how they have space on the floor, but last year, the Jazz were the number one team that ran the most picks, the number one team that ran the most handoffs in the league. Those still things are signatures of Quinn Snyder. The biggest question about the Utah Jazz is they had the best what's called QSQ, quantified shot quality on second spectrum. Was that because of the offense, or is, and that's basically your shot quality, or was that because Jay Crowder and Ricky Rubio and Derek Favors were left open all the time, and so they got open looks, or will this be, we'll see that Bogdanovich and the rest of the guys get the same looks, and then you have knockdown shooters taking the looks that used to be taken by some of the least good shooters in the league. Any of the players we thought of differently at the end of the season for the Utah Jazz, is it's an interesting thought, because what's the Jazz are a veteran team. Ed Davis, who they acquired as a backup center, we know exactly who he is. Mike Conley, I think we know exactly who he is. Rudy Gobert, two-time defensive player of the year, frankly could be thought of differently if the Jazz have a bad defensive season this year. And if the game really stretches out and spreads out and everyone's got shooters and ball handlers at the position and Gobert is pulled out to 24 feet more often and suddenly is not able to protect the rim like he has, he could be thought of less well than he has earlier in the season, but otherwise, or in his career. But otherwise, I think everyone is. The only one I might mention is Bojan Bogdanovic, who raised eyebrows last year in the second half of the season in Indiana when he was the primary scorer after Victor Oladipo went down, averaging about 20 points a game, putting up a 50-40 in that span. If the Jazz are very, very good, he becomes their second scorer. He would be the one who probably is thought of very differently by the end of the year. There's no question in regards to career trajectory that this is Donovan Mitchell's season. He's got the shoe from Adidas, the Don 1. He's got the national world recognition from Adidas. He had an equal year in year two to year one. And this is where he either becomes, you know, a different style player than Dwayne Wade and Allen Iverson, but that kind of superstar player, or whether he becomes Gilbert Arenas or Eric Gordon. This is the year in which we find out what happens with Donovan Mitchell and where his trajectory is heading. The Jazz are a veteran team. The only rookie that will probably get any time is Mia One. And that would be the only question mark there. I don't think he'll get a lot of time. This is not a team with rookies, and they only had 3 second-round draft picks, most of which will spend their time in the G League. The question for the Jazz, I think they'll be a home court advantage team in the Western Conference. The question, again, will be whether they can defend and rebound well enough. If this team is a top five defensive team, they'll be close to the one seed. If they're a top 10 defensive team, they'll be a home court team. And if they slip any further than that, then it'll be a disappointing season for them as they slide down out of the home court advantage in the first round of the Western Conference. So that's the breakdown of the Utah Jazz. Let's go find out tomorrow's headlines from our Rejecting the Screen team of Noah Kozlov and Adam Kozlov, plus what Josh Lloyd says on the fantasy end.
I can't imagine anybody being better to write tomorrow's headlines for the Utah Jazz than David Locke, but we'll give it a shot. Rudy for MVP. Now, if this is going to be one of the best defenses, and certainly I think it's going to be the best defense in the league, and Quinn Snyder's an outstanding coach, if it's the best defense in the league and an all-time defense, then why wouldn't the best defender on that team be considered for MVP? His basketball reference, his Hall of Fame probability, is at 0.5% for a guy who's been in, you know, had a good international career, and he's had back-to-back Defensive Player of the Year awards, and he's been to All-Star games also. And if Rudy can give you 18, 14, 2.5 blocks, why not?
I love it. And I think that's a very fair case for me, and not just because we're part of the Locked On Network. My future headline: Jazz clicking on all cylinders. You just talked about the defensive end of the floor, for sure. Gobert, Mike Conley. I don't see any weaknesses on this team. They have depth. Offensively, they have so many weapons. They're athletic. They can run. They have size. They can shoot it. And the biggest thing for me is that they have high character guys and a great coach. So I expect them to click instantly. Don't know if they'll win the West, but certainly nobody wants to see them in the playoffs. Jazz clicking on all cylinders, a headline we're going to be seeing all season long.
Figuring out how the Utah Jazz are going to run things this season is still a big question. Mike Conley comes in. They're going smaller with Derek Favors out and Bojan Bogdanovic in. Conley, you'd expect his usage to drop off now that he is with the Utah Jazz instead of the Memphis Grizzlies, but will that offset, or will that be offset by an increase in efficiency? I still think that given the lack of elite point guards, the third or fourth round is about the right spot for Conley, and that third round area for Donovan Mitchell is still the right area for him too. He should see an increase in his efficiency playing next to Conley. Mitchell's best fantasy games, though, tend to come when he is the point guard, and with Conley around, that will happen less often. So that is a small issue. If Mitchell can get to the free throw line a lot more, that could push him into the top 30. I don't expect really anything to change with Rudy Gobert this season. He's going to block his shots, get high field goal percentage, grab rebounds. In fact, the rebounds probably go up, considering it won't be Favors next to him. It will be Bogdanovic. We also don't know how the Bogdanovic and Ingles front court is going to work. Will Ingles come off the bench? Will it be Royce O'Neal starting? Will Jeff Green come in and start? Ingles still, you know, for his ability to get assists, he gets some steals, he can hit some threes. He's a strong later round guy, as is Bogdanovic. But Bojan's numbers for the Pacers last season were really fueled by the fact that Oladipo wasn't there. He comes to a situation where instead of being the number one offensive guy, he's probably the number three or number four guy. So expect his numbers to drop off and be more just of a late-round player for this Utah Jazz team.
The projection system loves the Jazz, and it's not just because of the fact that I built it and I work with them. So after you've heard what Adam Stanko and Josh Lloyd just had to say, you can decide whether you think this is legit. But the Jazz come out as the third-best offensive team and the third-best defensive team in the NBA, giving them a battle with the LA Clippers for the number one seed in the Western Conference. It's a little bit of what I said in the projection system as well. As I said, you know, frankly, if in fact these guys are good defensively, which the projection system has them to be, then they'll be close to the number one seed, and that's exactly where the system has them. We'll see whether or not that comes to fruition. Our fourth stop is the major turnover in Oklahoma City. What a division. Just changes everywhere. Eric G hosts Locked on Thunder. Let's hear what he has to say about the starless, well, not entirely with Chris Paul, but none of the big three are still around anymore.
I'm Eric G, host of the Locked on Thunder podcast, and this is my bite-sized preview of the upcoming season for the Oklahoma City Thunder 2019-2020 year. Starting with the biggest storylines now, you're probably thinking it's whether or not Chris Paul and Danilo Gallinari get traded, and you're not wrong, but for me, the much more interesting storyline this year is the development of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and whether or not this guy can actually challenge for a spot on the All-Star team in just his second year in the NBA. Now, this season, as long as Chris Paul stays in Oklahoma City, SGA is going to play the two a lot more than he's going to play his more natural position of the point guard. And so far for two games, two preseason games, one of those against the New Zealand Breakers from the NBL, SGA has already put up 42 points, and it's a quiet 42 points. He doesn't make statement baskets. He works within the framework of the offense. If you have three point guards out there, which the Thunder can with CP3, SGA, and Dennis Schroeder, he becomes the third ball handler, and when he brings the ball up court, he does a great job of making sure the guys are where they are supposed to be. He can guard multiple positions. He goes inside when it's called for, and he shoots when it's called for. He is the ultimate team player, unlike his predecessor, Russell Westbrook. And yes, I know Russell was a point guard, but eventually SGA will be the point guard of this team as well. He doesn't go out and look for assists, look for rebounds, and then look for points to just go about methodically getting a triple-double and not letting it organically happen. And while he's not the flashiest of players, and I think a lot of NBA fans will miss that, it won't go unnoticed by his peers or the coaches. And before you know it, SGA could be one of those guys that we are talking about as an all-star. His development, biggest, best story that's going on in Oklahoma City this year. Now, best case scenario for the Oklahoma City Thunder, in my opinion, is that Sam Presti gets a godfather offer for Danilo Gallinari and Chris Paul. And no, it's not lost on me that he's Italian. And yes, I did say that. I would like to see Danilo Gallinari and Chris Paul both get traded to add to that just ridiculous bounty of draft picks that Sam Presti got for Paul George, Russell Westbrook, and Jeremy Grant. This year alone, if you don't know, the Thunder already have three first-round picks. Now, one of those is a top 20 protected pick that they would lose if it fell out of the top 20 and it would go to the Philadelphia 76ers. They would also lose a pick that they got from Denver if for some reason the Nuggets went crashing down and ended up picking in the top 10. I would like some insurance on both of those situations. And if I believe Sam Presti, and in Sam I trust, that this is all about building for the future, then build for the future, because I don't think making the 7th or 8th spot really helps you build towards anything here in Oklahoma City. Let's get as many picks as we can and start developing these young guys. The worst case scenario for me is that you do make the playoffs, and then at the end of the year, Danilo Gallinari walks for nothing. And as we learn with Kevin Durant, in small market Oklahoma City, you never let your assets walk for absolutely nothing. You get something out of them if you possibly can. Will this team look stylistically different? Hell yes, they will. Because without Russell Westbrook, this ball's gonna move around a lot more. We've already seen that in the first two preseason games. Steven Adams is going to become a much bigger part of the offense this year. Even through all 48 minutes, the Thunder aren't just going to go to him in the first half. They are going to go to him throughout the entirety of the game. He and Chris Paul seem right now to be on the same page. Adams says they haven't butted heads yet, but when they do, they'll even get more on the same page. So the ball will move around more. Plus, you've got guys like Ferguson, Schroeder, Gallinari. You've got another guy in Mike Muscala, Darius Baisley. You've got all these three-point shooters on the team and a bunch of guys who are over 30%. They'll be a lot more deadly from three. In fact, more deadly from three than at any point in Oklahoma City's history. Player most likely to be looked at differently, Steven Adams. I think most people see him as an antiquated center whose skills don't fit today's NBA. But Adams already has a corner three this year. Happened in the first 90 seconds of their game with Dallas in Tulsa. But through a couple of games already, he's racked up 36 points, 13 rebounds. But most impressively, he's 69% from the free throw line, which is up from his career 55% and last year's 50%. So if Adams can actually hit from the free throw line, then you don't have to worry about taking him out down the stretch when the Hacker Adams defense gets employed by different coaches. I think Steven Adams is a guy that can be looked at very differently and very versatile. As far as rookies making an impact on this team, hey, there is only one guy we need to talk about. Well, there's really only one true rookie, and that's Darius Baisley, who through two games, again, we're talking preseason, but this kid can shoot. He's got beautiful rotation off the ball. His work with Mike Miller certainly helped him with the three. I believe the more he develops, he could actually be a guy, that rare beast that could play all five positions on the floor. Right now, the Thunder are running him at the four. They're running him at the three. He's not afraid to get physical. He's not afraid to go inside. He can shoot, and he can guard multiple positions. The year off from basketball hasn't hurt him, and he's making Sam Presti look like a mad genius. As far as my best guess for what happens this year is that the Thunder finish right outside the playoffs. They finish somewhere between 9th and 10th in the West, and then we start looking ahead to next year with a group of really good young players and a very bright future. I'm Eric G for the Locked On Thunder Podcast and the Locked On Podcast Network.
Thank you, Eric. One more stop, the Timberwolves around the corner. But first, let's get tomorrow's headlines from the Rejecting the Screen crew. Again, that available for you on iTunes as well as on Spotify, Stitcher. All the shows there for you. Sam Mitchell's their guest this week, Rejecting the Screen. We'll have one day a week where they do kind of an NBA conversation, and then another day of the week where they do a long-form interview. We don't have anything like that on the Lockdown Podcast Network, so we're really excited. And Sam Mitchell is the guest this week. All right, now let's go to Noah and Adam.
Here's what I see coming for the Oklahoma City Thunder, Adam. And I think I really like a lot of the young pieces. I think it's going to be a team that's going to lose a bunch of games, but I think they're going to be playing a lot of close games. But it's a comment that you'll see on Twitter all the time about the Oklahoma City Thunder. And it's, as always, if you see it a lot on Twitter, it drives me nuts. Steven Adams is a treasure. That's what we're going to see. And that's the headline. All right. We get it. He's got a great accent. He's not from here. He's a bit different. He's a treasure. Okay. Now let's come up with something new, or let's learn some more about him. Enough of this. Steven Adams is a treasure.
For me, the future headline is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander learning so much from CP3.
You can picture this
bad boy coming.
Yeah.
Now, Gilgeous-Alexander spent one season at Kentucky, one in the NBA. He's just 21 years old, got a great feel for the game, but he's young. Chris Paul, 34. And I think we're going to see Chris Paul excited to prove the doubters wrong, which could also probably be its own headline. But I think one other thing will be a guy in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who is known for having a great feel for the game, but is still so raw and inexperienced, is just going to learn so many tricks of the trade from CP3. And I think he'll talk about how much he's learned from Chris Paul. And Chris Paul is going to take on a mentoring role much more than he ever could have in Houston.
There's probably more questions about the Thunder than any team in the NBA. Will Chris Paul stay healthy? Will Danilo Gallinari stay healthy? How long will they actually be on this team for? Because if they're there and healthy, then Chris Paul's a top 15 type of guy. Gallinari could be a top 25 guy as these guys really start to run this offense. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he's going to be the starting shooting guard, but if Chris Paul gets hurt or traded, does he become the point guard then? He is a really strong mid-round pick, Gilgeous-Alexander, who's looked great in preseason, but if he forces himself into that point guard role more often, then his value goes higher as the assists start to come in, versus playing off the ball where they won't quite be as high. So some real value in Gallinari, in Paul, in Gilgeous-Alexander. At small forward, it's likely to be Terrence Ferguson there. He is nothing more than a three-point streaming option, not really worth paying attention to. They also lost Jeremy Grant, but Gallinari is going to be filling that role. I also see Steven Adams' usage increasing a little bit, and especially his rebound rate. Russell Westbrook used to take all of those rebounds. Adams is going to grab those again, but his horrific free throw shooting is a real concern, and that is going to be something you have to take into account if you are drafting Steven Adams in fantasy.
The final stop takes us to the Minnesota Timberwolves with the great Carl Anthony Towns and with first-year full head coach coming for the Timberwolves with Flip Saunders' son taking over. Ben Beckin is the host of Locked On Wolves, gives us the breakdown.
What's up, everybody? This is Ben Beacon with Locked On Wolves. First off, the biggest storylines for the Timberwolves. Number one is the new look offense under new head coach Ryan Saunders, who was promoted interim head coach last January and was hired as the full-time head coach in the offseason. He is implementing an entirely new offense, kind of remade in his own image, as well as the new front office led by Gerson Rosas. And he's got a new offensive coordinator on the bench with him this year, Pablo Prigioni, longtime NBA player, I guess longer time overseas player, recently retired NBA player who was on the Brooklyn Nets staff last year with a team that had a potent offense and surprised a lot of people with their playoff run. So between Saunders and Prigioni and the new look front office, the Wolves are going to be a very different offense than what they had under Tom Thibodeau in recent years. They're going to shoot a lot more threes. We've already seen that through the first part of the preseason, and that's going to be very, very evident early on in the season once we get into the regular season. The second thing is Carl Anthony Towns, his progression in all facets of his game. He's already a great offensive player. We know that. He's clearly improving on defense, had a much better season in his second All-Star campaign, his fourth season in the league last year, and we'll be looking to improve on that again this year. And really just incremental improvements on defense is enough with how good he is on offense. Of course, if he so chooses to make a leap on defense and become a top flight defender as far as big men go in the league, that would be huge. He also needs to improve as a leader, and I think the Wolves have now empowered him to do that. It's a little bit different than the Tom Thibodeau regime, and I think that with the backing of the front office and the coaching staff and the relationship he's got with new head coach Ryan Saunders, the Wolves are going to go as far as Cat takes them, and Towns is going to have every opportunity this year to show that he can be that leader for the organization as they move forward. The third thing is Jarrett Culver, the sixth overall pick in the draft. The Timberwolves, it's unclear whether or not they really wanted to draft him at number six, but they got him, and he's been extremely exciting thus far in preseason. The Wolves are very high on what his ceiling could be. he could be a legit Rookie of the Year candidate this year, and that in itself is a storyline. It's been a while since the Wolves have had a rookie that will have the opportunity in terms of minutes. I mean, I guess you go back to Townsend his rookie year and before that, Wiggins. But Culver could be a legitimately solid NBA player from day one. He's probably not going to start, but he's going to be the first or second guy off the bench, and we'll get 20-plus minutes a night. And every bit of the opportunity to challenge for a Rookie of the Year or challenge any other rookies for the Rookie of the Year award and have a real shot at winning it when it's all said and done. I think in terms of best case scenario for the Timberwolves this year, if Robert Covington returns from his arthroscopic knee surgery in the offseason, remember he got hurt on New Year's Eve last year and didn't play a game the rest of the season. It was somewhat surprising. He had surgery in the spring. And if he returns to form, and it looks like so far he has, and he returns to the Defensive Player of the Year conversation, he was every bit a part of that conversation all the way through Christmas last year before his injury. And Towns continues his progression as a superstar. You know, again, even incremental improvements going from a top 20 to a top 15 to a top 10 player, this team could very well be a playoff team. If you've got the Defensive Player of the Year in Covington and you've got an up-and-coming superstar top 10 or 12 player in Towns, that equals a playoff team, even with reasonable depth, and that's what they've got. On the flip side of that coin, the worst case scenario is that the Wolves implement this new offense that centers around the three ball, which I do think is the right thing to do, but they might not have the personnel to execute it. There aren't very many players on the roster that are career above average three-point shooters. The list is essentially Karl-Anthony Towns. He's the only one that's you could even classify as a sharpshooter, you know, sniffing 40% for his career from beyond the arc, and he's hit 40% or greater the last two seasons. Robert Covington's above average, but his bigger thing is volume and the amount of threes he shoots. And, you know, before last year, I would have said Jeff Teague, but Teague was bad from beyond the arc last year and seemed afraid to shoot the long ball. That's about it. The rest of the guys who are going to launch threes are league average-ish or even worse. As much as Gerson Rosas, who came from the Rockets organization after 17 years in their front office, as much as he says this isn't going to be Houston Rockets North, so far, there's a lot of indications that it's going to be pretty similar. And there's nothing wrong with that. Clearly, the Rockets have been extremely successful over the past couple of decades, but that's going to be the biggest change on the offensive end of the floor. On defense, the Wolves, I mentioned the new offensive coordinator and Pablo Prigioni. Their new defensive coordinator is David Vanterpool, who was Terry Stotts' right-hand man in Portland the last several years and has interviewed for a number of head coaching roles. It was a coup for the Wolves to hire him away from Portland. And, you know, he was rumored to be the runner-up for the job that Ryan Saunders ultimately got. And Vanterpool was named the associate head coach and will function as the defensive coordinator. The Wolves defense will go from Tom Thibodeau's once revolutionary and now passe ice defense and those concepts to switching the majority of the time. And the Wolves, if you look at the acquisitions they made, the guys who are gone and the guys who are new to the team, clearly the Wolves are focused on finding guys that can guard multiple positions and switch, maybe not quite 1 through 5, but pretty close to it. Towns has great switchability. Even additions like Noah Vonleh and Jordan Bell can guard at least 2, if not 3 positions in a pinch. Jarrett Culver can probably guard 3 positions at the NBA level. Jake Lehman, same thing. There's clearly a focus on guys who can switch seamlessly and, you know, or perhaps best case scenario, stay home on their man, but switch if they need to and be effective. The Wolves aren't going to be icing the pick and roll like they had been the past few years. That concept wasn't working anymore with the proclivity for outside shots of teams in today's NBA. And this new concept on defense of switching almost everything and trying their best to stay home when possible is going to be a shock compared to what they've done in the past. I think by the time we get to the end of the season, the players that are going to get the opportunity to do some things they couldn't do at their last stop that maybe thought of differently, you know, when we're sitting here in 6 months, is going to be either Jake Lehman or Jordan Bell. Jake Lehman hardly played his first 2 years in Portland, was a rotation player and even a starter. He started almost a third, or I guess a little more than a third of games in Portland last year, fell out of the rotation by playoff time, was extremely streaky. My best guess on a win total for the Timberwolves this year is 42 to 43 wins. I'll go ahead and say 43 wins for the year. I don't think that's going to be enough to make the playoffs in the Western Conference. It's been the last couple of years. It took, I think the Wolves made it 2 years ago with 47 wins as the eighth seed. I think last year the eighth seed had 48 wins. You'd have to go back 3 years to find a team with 43 wins making the playoffs in the West. The West only got better this offseason, so it would be a mild surprise to see the Wolves in the playoffs, especially if they do only win 43 games. The Vegas over-under was set at 35.5, and I think that that was far too low. The Wolves should be in the conversation throughout the season as a potential playoff team. I would expect them to try and be active over the summer, next summer, as they try and improve from a low 40s win team to a 50 win team, perhaps, and beyond. They may even be active at the trade deadline this year, depending on how things shake out early in the season and if they're able to stay healthy. But I think if all things are considered equal, the most likely scenario is they're hitting the over in Vegas and they're in the low 40s win total but miss the playoffs. And we do see some improvement from Towns, a rookie of the year type campaign from Jarrett Culver, and perhaps a defensive player of the year type campaign from Robert Covington. And the Wolves should be a lot of fun to watch this year. There should be a lot of threes being launched, a lot of Karl-Anthony Towns handling the ball on the perimeter and in the post. And, you know, really a new day in Minnesota as they band together under their new head coach, Ryan Saunders.
The final stops on our Northwest Division preview. Let's hit the two breakdowns first, tomorrow's headlines, and then Josh Lloyd and Locked On Fantasy.
The Minnesota Timberwolves. Here's the headline. What culture? I like Josh Okogie, but Karl-Anthony Towns always acts like he wants to be the leader. It doesn't really impact anything on the court. He's a terrific offensive player. Always produces. Always plays, too. I mean, last year, it's the first time he didn't play all 82. He always plays. This team's been in the playoffs once at him in 15 years. And that was when they had Jimmy Butler. And then Jimmy Butler happened, and then they didn't get back there. What culture is this that the Wolves speak of? And can Karl-Anthony Towns develop anything of a culture? And in the Western Conference, you want to build a culture? Better get to the playoffs.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure about what their culture is, but my future headline is sneaky fun watch on League Pass.
Oh, this team, sneaky fun. Oh God.
This team, you know, I said it to infuriate you. This team has some athletic pieces. I mean, you talked about Towns for sure, but Andrew Wiggins, who I still have not given up on, I'm probably the last one. It's funny how certain guys in the league, everyone feels like they can all just pile on. And Andrew Wiggins has become one of those guys. Drafted Jarrett Culver, who I absolutely love, out of Texas Tech. Does a lot of things really well on the defensive end. Offensively creates for others. Great athlete. Okogie, you referred to. Great athlete. Good defensive player. Jordan Bell comes over. He gets a fresh start. Was always seemingly in Steve Kerr's doghouse. Robert Covington. Rocco. A lot of people really like watching Covington. And maybe even Naz Reid could be a rotation guy at some point. Maybe not this season, but in the future. So I don't know about the culture. I don't know about the wins. But I want to check them out on League Pass.
Karl-Anthony Towns for the Minnesota Timberwolves is well in the conversation to be the number one overall pick. Under Ryan Saunders last year, we saw the offense run through Towns more. I think we're going to see more of that this season. More assists. He's an elite three-point shooter for a big man. He grabs boards. He's going to score, you know, 25-plus points per game. Really, really excited for Towns. And if you took him at number one, I don't think it would be the wrong decision. Robert Covington also, his ability to get steals and blocks and rebounds and hit threes, that's all going to be really valuable for fantasy. Could be a top 50 guy. Probably don't need to pick him in the top 50 in a lot of situations, but can be underrated depending on what platform you're playing on. And Jeff Teague, given the fact that assists can be quite hard to get in fantasy, he averaged over 8 of them a game last season. He should be seeing a little bit of a bounce back. Hopefully now that he's fully healthy after missing about 40 games last season, we should get a more impactful Jeff Teague. As for Andrew Wiggins, he's only really useful in points leagues for fantasy. I think he's still worth taking a flyer on in category leagues with your last one or two picks just to see if he can improve. But we're 5 years into the Andrew Wiggins experience and haven't really seen any of that occur at this stage. So, having a healthy dose of skepticism is useful, I think. As for the last starting spot, Josh Okogie or Jarrett Culver, I thought Okogie would get that spot. Culver's been impressive in preseason. I think if you're going to take a flyer on either of these guys with your last pick in a draft, it's probably going to be Culver, who can come in and play the backup point guard role behind Teague, who can get some defensive numbers. There are going to be concerns with his shooting, of course, as there is with all rookies heading into the league, and Culver will be no exception. But it looks like he's going to have a rotation role immediately, and that could push towards 30 minutes as the season goes on.
The Western Conference is wrapped up on the Locked On NBA previews here. If you haven't heard the Pacific Division or the Southwest, there for you. We'll start in the Eastern Conference for you tomorrow. It's all on the Locked On Podcast Network. Go grab Rejecting the Screen. We have other big news coming before the week is done on the Locked On Podcast Network, so make sure you're ready for all of that. It's all coming up here on the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.